that I'm lucky? Aha, I know why it wasn't working. We were waiting for Mrs. Neo. It wouldn't work until you came. You must have good powers. This is quoting from the Anapanasati Sutta, Bhikkhus, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing, that's Anapanasati, is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness, the four Satipatthana. When the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance. So what he's saying here, that when Anapanasati is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four Satipatthanas. I was just mentioning what I said yesterday, that there is no difference between Anapanasati and Vipassana. Anapanasati fulfills the four enlightenment factors, the four Satipatthanas. So, on this retreat, you're doing Anapanasati, you're also doing Satipatthana. If you fulfill Anapanasati, you fulfill the four Satipatthanas. So there's no difference between Satipatthana practice and Anapanasati. Do you get it? Okay. So enough about that. The four Satipatthanas are all about mindfulness. But so is Anapanasati about mindfulness. And there are different levels of mindfulness which are important for you to understand this meditation retreat. The mindfulness which you experience in ordinary life is not all that solid, it's not all that deep. And many people, because of a lack of experience, don't realize what powerful mindfulness is like. In this retreat, because you are calming the mind, I hope you will discover that your mindfulness increases to a different order. That mindfulness, when it becomes very strong, becomes very powerful. The mindfulness is like awareness, alertness, the ability to know clearly what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're smelling, what you're tasting, even what you're feeling in your body. For example, it's one of the experiences which a few meditators have had already, which many of you probably will have. Just before your body disappears in this meditation, when you get into the states of mind, your mindfulness gets so strong that your body appears to be itching, like ants crawling all over it. You can feel the body with intensity, which you don't usually have. And sometimes people always ask, what's going on there? I feel like things are crawling all over me, just itching, it's just so intense. All that's happening there is your mindfulness is increasing. What you're seeing with more power, with more depth. Mindfulness is filling out the details. Your mindfulness is growing in intensity. For most people, their mindfulness is like at night time, when all the lights are dimmed and you can't see very clearly. You think you can see because that's all you're used to. It's your common everyday experience to be going through life in shadows, not seeing all the details. I gave a simile of that the last couple of days of going up the hill to my monastery, looking through the window of a car. I thought I knew that hillside, but I had to stop and be still to really see it deeply. Ordinary mindfulness is like watching through the window of a car. You think you understand, you think you see, but you see very, very little detail. You don't see the thing fully. Slow down, stop, and you have a chance to see it fully. As you slow your mind down and you start to begin to stop, you start to see your body fully. That's why it's just so itchy, so tingly, just before it disappears. Your mindfulness is increasing. The experiences which I had when I started practicing meditation, again, were quite strange. One of the first experiences of increased mindfulness that I had was after my first meditation retreat while I was still a student at Cambridge. Every morning we were allowed to go for a walk outside for exercise. And knowing Cambridge very well, I always headed for the botanical gardens, which were just maybe 5 minutes from our boarding houses where we were holding the retreat. And when I got to those botanical gardens, I was supposed to have a walk, but I couldn't get past the gate to those gardens. Just inside the gate of the botanical gardens in Cambridge at that time, there was a clump of bamboo. That clump of bamboo looked so beautiful to me. It was so slender, the colors were just so vibrant, just the way it was all proportioned was so entrancing, I couldn't move past that clump of bamboo. It was captivating. I stood for about 10 or 15 minutes. It was very lucky it was early in the morning. If someone had seen me in the middle of the day, they'd have probably thought I was on some sort of drugs and probably carted me off to the hospital. People don't just stand in awe at a clump of bamboo for minutes at a time. It was early in the morning, and I soon saw a little bench close by. I sat on that bench and for the rest of the hour just stared at that clump of bamboo, enjoying all of its beauty. By the end of the hour, I had to go back to the meditation retreat. I had to tear myself away, but I promised myself I'd go back there in the morning. For those 9 days of the retreat, for 8 mornings, I went back to that clump of bamboo. I didn't exercise, I just watched in awe at its great beauty. I'd never seen such a beautiful piece of bamboo in all my life. The other day I went down by the river. I did get some exercise that day. But what happened after the retreat was finished, when I went back to my college, when I was working, I had a free afternoon. I decided to get on my bicycle. They always use bicycles in Cambridge. I decided to get on my bicycle and go and visit my friend, the most beautiful piece of bamboo in the world. When I got to the botanical gardens, I got through the entrance. All I saw was this grey, spindly, uninteresting, uninspiring little piece of second-class bamboo. I wondered, where had my beautiful piece of bamboo gone? It was the same bamboo, but now it no longer looked beautiful. I couldn't understand at first why there was this big change until I realized about mindfulness. During the retreat, I gained some stillness. My mind had become peaceful. Because it had been still and peaceful, I could notice so much more of what was happening in an ordinary clump of bamboo. When I was studying, especially after going through the Cambridge traffic in a bicycle, when I got to that clump of bamboo, I was stressed. I didn't realize I was stressed because that was normal to me. But my mind wasn't still enough to appreciate the beauty in that clump of bamboo. My mind was dull. The lights were dim. I couldn't see clearly what was really there. I needed to meditate for many days to calm my mind, to gain the sort of mindfulness, the strength of mindfulness, to see deeply into a clump of bamboo and really appreciate it. That experience happens very often. The next major time which I remember was my first year or two in our monastery in northeast Thailand. During the rains retreat, we'd do walking meditation. That walking meditation had to be performed in the hall because it was pouring with rain outside. So I, with many other monks, were walking up and down in the hall. The hall didn't have a nice marble floor like this hall. It had an old concrete floor. Walking backwards and forwards with my attention some 2 meters in front of my feet, I had to stop. I had to stop because a piece of concrete in front of me started to appear so beautiful. It was the most beautiful piece of concrete I'd ever seen. The greys arranged themselves into the most delicious of shapes. The texture stood out in great relief. I was in awe of what I was seeing in this piece of concrete laid by the villagers in an old hall in northeast Thailand. I thought at the time I should cut that piece of concrete out and send it to some art gallery in London. It was that beautiful. Again, it wasn't until after I realized what was happening. That concrete was just ordinary, but when mindfulness becomes strong, when mindfulness becomes really bright, you can look at a piece of concrete and you can see far more in that than the ordinary mind can. It starts to look very, very beautiful, rich in its detail and texture. What was there all along, which you could not see because your mindfulness wasn't strong enough, now appears in all its depth and beauty. This is a common experience for meditators. If you have a very deep meditation, you go out afterwards and you find the leaves on the plants outside are so much more green than you've ever seen before. They're shining, they're brilliant. You can't believe how beautiful they are. If you go and eat your meal, your lunch, that is delicious. I noticed that the food on retreat was the most beautiful food I could ever eat. And I wondered why it was. Was it that the people who make food for the yogis give it extra special care? No. It is ordinary food, but your mindfulness increases so you can taste much more of what's in that food. You're picking up more of the tastes. If you get into a very deep meditation, that food on the table waiting for you at 11:30 will be five-star cuisine. That tastes good. And you won't believe how well it tastes. And why does it taste like that? It's because your mindfulness has deepened. Your mindfulness has become powerful. You've gained what we call superpower mindfulness. You've turned up the lights in your mind. So instead of having this small little flashlight trying to find your way with batteries which are dull, you've got this superpower searchlight which illuminates everything, which sees all the details in front of you. Now that's called mindfulness. When the mind is full with bright lights, able to see deeply into things. Ordinary people's so-called mindfulness is not mindfulness, it's mind half-fullness, or mind quarter-fullness, or mind mostly emptiness. That's what most people's minds are like. Now, of course, people think, okay, yeah, that's just what Ajahn Brahm says. I like people to experience that. I like people to be walking and see that piece of marble in front of you turn into the most amazing picture you've ever seen in your whole life. Wow, this is really good. To see so deeply and to see so happily into things. Or to see a leaf like you've never seen it before. I like people to experience these strange altered states of mindfulness. Simply because they will know what we're talking about. Why there are so many different levels of mindfulness, and the ordinary levels are basically not useful. They're not powerful enough to see the Dhamma of the Buddha. Another important part about that mindfulness needs to be strong, needs to be strengthened for the sake of energy, for the sake of happiness, for the sake of bliss. This was one important rule of Dhamma, which I discovered from my own practice. Just like scientists discover rules of nature, laws of physics, there's a law of the mind, which is very important for you to know. And that is that if you put your energy into mindfulness, if you put your effort into knowing, if you direct all of your energy just into knowing, and you take it away completely from all doing, complaining, managing, changing, arranging, thinking. All that which is the active part of the mind, you subdue. And you keep all the energy just on the knowing. You will find that that energy of your being all flows into one place, the knowing, mindfulness. That's how mindfulness does become bright. mindfulness brightens on a retreat to the extent that you are still, that you're not doing anything, that you're not wasting all the energy on trying to change, to struggle, to strive. When the energy flows into mindfulness, then mindfulness becomes bright. You become more alert. You become more awake, more alive. And more importantly, you find you become more happy. The happiness which yogis feel on a retreat is a direct result of how much energy is flowing into their mindfulness at the expense of all they're doing. Your normal person moves so much. They think their reins get rid of battle, strive, struggle. That's a waste of your energy. Leave that alone. Let it be. Door of my heart's open to this, no matter what's happening. Don't struggle, don't strive, don't make war on the present moment, no matter what it is. Leave it alone. What happens is you find, because you're not making war, all of your resources, how much of the gross national product of a country goes into defense? When I went past the military installations in England, I commented to my driver, they call that Ministry of Defense. That is a misnomer. It should be called the Ministry of Attack, because that's what those things are used for. There's no such thing as a defense minister. They're attack ministers. It's the Ministry of Attack, not the Ministry of Defense. Even in the US, they call it the Defense Department, don't they? They should call it the Attack Department. That'll be closer to the truth. How much of a country's resources goes into that attack, into that struggle? Huge billions of dollars go into the US attack budget, not defense budget. Now imagine if all of that energy went into other areas. How much more happiness and well-being there will be in society. Now you've got your ministry of attack inside your brain. Attacking your defilements, attacking your pain, attacking anything you don't like. Attack, attack, attack. Struggle, struggle, struggle. Fight, fight, fight. Inordinate amounts of your energy go into changing your world. Because of that, most human beings don't have enough energy left to know. Mindfulness is dull, run down, unable to fully see what's happening, and unable to gain the energy due to mindfulness. So this meditation retreat, you relax, you don't do anything. Take away from the struggle, and the energy will start going into mindfulness instead. When that happens, you get brighter. You see more. You feel more. The food tastes better. The mind can see the breath with more clarity. You can feel the body with more alertness. Everything becomes more alive, more awake, more clear. It's like you've been driving in a car with a dirty windscreen, and now your windscreen is becoming clear. You can see things. You're turning on the headlights of your car. Super headlights. High beam, intense beam, so you can see everything in the road in front of you with amazing clarity. And you're getting happiness. As the mind energizes, as all the effort goes into mindfulness, knowing, you get clarity, you get energy, and you get happiness. I mentioned that when you see a piece of concrete, an ordinary piece of concrete with full mindfulness, it is the most beautiful thing in the world. That was the other thing which I wanted to investigate. Why was it beautiful? Why was it so lovely to see that clump of bamboo? The beauty did not lie in the concrete. The happiness did not lie in that clump of bamboo. It lay in my mind. My mind was happy to see that. My mind was happy, was joyful to see the concrete. when you put energy into mindfulness, happiness comes. You are a happy person. That's why I can tell, this is the Buddha's way of meditation. That's why I can tell how a person's meditation is going. You don't have to come into the interview and report all your experiences to me. I need to take one look at you and see how much you're smiling. Those of you who are miserable have never learned yet what meditation is really about. Those of you who've got horizontal mouths don't understand happiness born of deep mindfulness. The more mindfulness you have, the more the corners of your mouth turn upwards. You get very happy. And when I see these happy meditators, I know they're getting the message. They're actually developing. And when you get into a deep meditation state, that's when you come and see me. That's one of the most enjoyable experiences for a teacher. When somebody comes with his big wide eyes, the same sort of expression on their face when they've just fallen in love. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, it's so wonderful. Oh, at last I've got it. Oh, it's so nice. Oh, it's so wonderful. Oh, it's so delicious. I so enjoy it when meditators come and see me and say that. When tears flow down their cheeks, they're so happy. A happiness better than sex. A happiness which is so delicious, which lasts for such a long time. And some people come and say, be careful, you get attached to that. You don't get attached to that happiness. That's a happiness of mindfulness. It's a happiness of letting go. You're supposed to attach to that, said the Buddha. The Buddha said, anyone who indulges in the pleasures of deep meditation, especially anyone who indulges in the pleasures of jhana, what happens to them? This is in the Parsādhika Sutta of the Digha Nikāya. Anyone who indulges in the pleasures of deep meditation can expect one of four results. And only those four results. This is the only thing which can happen to you if you indulge in the pleasure of meditation. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment, arahat. That is the result of indulging in the pleasures of meditation. So is that dangerous? Is that something to be afraid of? Is that something to stop? Isn't that what we're supposed to do? Become stream winners, once returners, non-returners, arahats? So if you get some good meditation coming along, indulge in it. Make much of it. Don't be afraid of it. Get into it. Because you find that that's going to lead to you being a stream winner, once returner, non-returner, or arahat. That's not Ajahn Brahm saying this. That's the Buddha in the Parsādhika Sutta, Digha Nikāya. Read it. So when the happiness starts to come, enjoy it. Make much of it. Really get into it. As I said last night, you deserve that. That's a result of your good karma. Isn't meditation supposed to be one of the best karmas you can ever do? If it's good karma, where's the result? That's the result. Happiness here and now, and happiness afterwards, stream winning, once returning, non-returning, arahat. That's what's supposed to happen. If you get pain and suffering, that must be because of your bad karma. That's why the in the sutras, someone came along and said, the Jains were into going through pain. Standing on one leg, facing the sun, not eating, going naked. The Jains were the ascetics at that time. And the Buddha was quite critical of them, and also quite sarcastic. He said, those Jains, you can see them exerting themselves, going naked, hardly eating, standing one foot, enduring pain. They think by enduring that pain, they'll somehow wear out their bad karma. He said, look how much pain they're going through. They're going through such a lot of pain. Surely there must be very, very bad people to have to endure that bad, the fruit of that bad karma. Because the more you endure pain, isn't that mean the more bad karma you've done? So, if you're somebody who meditates for the sake of pain, you must have done lots of bad karma. If you're a meditator who enjoys lots and lots of happiness, then you must be a meditator who's done lots of good karma. Understand? So, mindfulness gets strong through the power of stillness. Remember what that stillness is. It's actually letting go of the doer. Letting go of forcing, struggling. Now what happens when you put all the energy into doing, into knowing? At first, when one tries to let go of the doer, because we aren't really clear of what this knowing business is, of mindfulness is, we tend, when we first start to meditate in this fashion, is to let go of both the doer and the knower. Now please remember, those two parts of the mind, the doer is the active part of the mind, that which causes you to think, to manage, to scratch your head, to move your bottom, to go here, to go there, to struggle, to force, to fight, is what does things. That's the active part of the mind, that's the doer. Even sometimes you think you're letting go, but you're doing letting go. And that's still the active part of the mind. Come on, let go, you tell yourself. Come on, let go. This meditation, I'm really going to let go. But that's more doing. That's not letting go. That's managing, that's forcing, struggling. That cannot be letting go. That's the active part of the mind. The passive part of the mind is that which can hear me right now, but which doesn't react. The passive part of the mind is that which can feel your body, but doesn't react. Which can know without thinking. Giving something a name, noting, is reacting. So real mindfulness is just knowing. Because people don't know the real difference between the doing mind and the knowing mind. When we start calming things down, we calm down both the doing and the knowing. We calm both down. We don't get restless, we don't think about things, but also we don't know anything. We go to sleep. We doze. When you start to doze, it's a good sign. Of all those hindrances, sleepiness is the one which you shouldn't be so worried about. The reason for this is because great nodders become great meditators. The first of those great nodders was Mahamoggallana, who the Buddha saw was nodding, was going asleep during his meditation. 3 or 4 days later, he became Mahamoggallana, the great arahant, the great meditator with immense psychic powers. One of the two chief disciples of the Buddha. So, if you've been sleeping this meditation, perhaps that's what's going to happen to you. One of my favorite stories from the suttas is of the Buddha walking with Venerable Ananda, his attendant. They saw a monk, a bhikkhu, sitting dead straight with the perfect posture, his back straight, his head still. And the Buddha turned round to Venerable Ananda and said, I'm worried about him. And sure enough, 2 weeks later he disrobed and was getting married. He went to a different part of the forest, and this time he saw another monk, another bhikkhu, nodding. And the Buddha turned to Venerable Ananda and smiled. He said, I'm not worried about that monk at all. 2 weeks later, he became fully enlightened, an arahat. If I see you nodding, I'm not worried about it. because you're starting to let go. There was a fellow monk, a French monk. I was just about 1 year senior to him. I spent the range retreat with him in my fourth range retreat, his third. He would always sit absolutely straight. He would, even in the early morning, in the hot weather, the humid jungles of Thailand, he would never, I never saw him nodding once. At that time I thought, now that's a really good monk. And I was so surprised that I found out about 6 months later he disrobed. I've got his bowl. His bowl he gave to me when he disrobed, and I've still got it, this 26 years later. He told me that when he saw any of the other monks nodding, he felt so jealous. If only I could have that much peace. Because whenever he was sitting, he was never at peace for a moment. Always struggling, always thinking, always restless, always controlling. And he could never find peace at all, which is why he was so straight. That shocked me at the time, but I realized since how true that is. If you can let go and relax enough to nod, you're on the way. So all of those who are sleepy, well done. Because what happens? All those who are struggling, they're thinking, thinking, thinking. You've got a long way to go yet. Because what happens after a while, if you have that hindrance, please do not struggle with it. Be at peace with it. Because what's happening is you've let go of the knower, you've let go of the doer, both at the same time. Because you haven't given any, well, you're not giving any energy into struggling. If you leave it alone, relax, enjoy even, be at peace with it, then when you're not struggling, all the energy which is there somewhere starts to trickle into the knowing. If you just allow yourself to be dozy, after a while you wake up naturally. If you struggle, 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 it will take much longer to wake up because you are wasting energy. Do not waste energy. You're dozy, sleepy, not clear, don't do anything. Because doing anything is wasting your energy. Allow the energy not to go into doing, to struggling, trying to get rid of doziness. Allow it to flow naturally into the other half of the mind, knowing. You start to wake up. The mind will start to brighten. It's just like the energy in the batteries of your light have gone down. You need to allow them just to recuperate, to come up naturally. You don't need to do anything. The more you do, the longer it takes. Relax, let go, be kind. The door of my heart is open to you. Sleepiness. Be content with sleepiness. Let go, don't crave, don't do. Third Noble Truth meditation, remember? Be at peace with your sleepiness. And then you'll find that the sleepiness starts to vanish. And when it starts to vanish because you haven't given any energy into struggling, your sleepiness is not replaced by restlessness. Instead, your sleepiness is replaced by alertness, which is still. Mindfulness, which doesn't move, which gets stronger and stronger and stronger. People who struggle with sleepiness then get into restlessness. And their meditation is just a battle between restlessness and sleepiness. Now they're sleepy, they struggle. Now they're restless, they can't stop thinking. Now they're sleepy. Now they're restless. They just go on those two extremes because they don't deal with their meditation in a proper way. They don't deal with doziness in a proper way. Be still with doziness. Don't do anything. Don't struggle. Don't fight. Don't make war with sleepiness. Make peace. The energies will come by themselves. When they do come, because you haven't made war, because you haven't struggled, because you haven't given energy You give no energy into doing. You find when the energy flows into knowing, you still maintain your stillness. And the energy goes more into knowing. Your mind becomes bright. It becomes happy. It becomes able just to watch the breath for hours. Content, happy, clear. That's why in these meditation retreats, the first couple of days, I encourage you to sleep. And people think, what is Ajahn Brahm doing? Aren't we supposed to meditate? Aren't we supposed to go? Aren't these defilements? They are defilements, but this is the way you overcome these. I've done this many times. Teaching retreats, I know what works. I know the nature of mind. Sometimes people misunderstand. This is psychology. This actually works. They have something in the West called reverse psychology. If you want to have somebody do something, you say, don't do it. If you want children to come to the temple, ban them from coming to the temple. And then they want to come. This is how you use the psychology to get the mind bright. So the first couple of days, be sleeping. Par for the course. Don't struggle with it. Don't fight it. Allow it to be. And you'll find by the middle of the retreat, it's not what you're doing, it's what you're not doing. The mind becomes bright. It's much easier to watch the breath. And it's much happier to watch the breath. You get joy doing it. 4 or 5 days into the retreat, you're really enjoying this. And it's so easy. 6 or 7, 8 days into the retreat, you hardly want to sleep. By the end of the retreat, you don't want to go home. That's why when they take photographs of the yogis at the end of my retreat, they're not happy. They're all miserable. It's not because they've been having a hard time, it's because they're having a good time. Now they're going home. Ooh, I don't want to go home. For most retreats, when they take photographs, that's the happiest time at the end of the retreat. Why are they happy? Because they're going home. So, wouldn't it be wonderful to have happiness in this retreat? That happiness is a measure of your mindfulness, the measure of the energy. If you have strong mindfulness, you are happy. Inner happiness, inner energy. And that's how I measure people's mindfulness. They don't have to tell me what they're seeing. I want to know how they're seeing it. Whether they're seeing it with brightness, with joy. Later on, I'm going to talk in length about the Anapanasati Sutta. What the Buddha said were the 16 steps of Anapanasati. To say what fulfills the four focuses of mindfulness, the 4 satipatthanas. To fulfill the 4 satipatthanas, you have to fulfill the Anapanasati, so I just read. What are the 5th and 6th factors of Anapanasati? For those of you who know that sutta, you will know that that is breathing in, breathing out, developing happiness. Breathing in and breathing out, developing joy. In the 5th and 6th stages of Anapanasati, you're supposed to develop happiness and joy. That is what the Buddha said. That is one of the reasons why people fail at breath meditation. They don't read the instructions. The instructions say, step number 5, step number 6, develop happiness, develop joy. If you're going to do Satipatthana, you have to develop happiness and joy. That is a sign of the strength of your mindfulness. That's part of the path. That's the Buddha's instructions. So those of you who develop misery, develop grumpiness, develop pain, struggle, strife, you are not following the Buddha's path. You're not following his instructions. You are not developing mindfulness at all. Your mindfulness is dull when you have pain. You develop happiness, strong mindfulness, strong joy. The stronger the joy, the deeper your mindfulness. That is a natural law. So you find, as you practice in this retreat, it's not just for the sake of happiness and having a good time. This is the energy of the mind you're developing, the power of mindfulness. And this is where you get the interesting, amazing experiences, the things you can tell other people about afterwards. Wow, I was meditating here, and I looked at that piece of marble, and wow, that was amazing, just how that transformed into such a landscape. I was just eating my food, and just, you know, that one piece of carrot was the most delicious piece of carrot I've ever tasted in my whole existence. Amazing. I was sitting here one evening, and I just didn't want to come out. I didn't go to bed till 1 or 2 o'clock, who cares? Those things will happen to you once you get the energy rolling into the mindfulness. So you see what I've been talking about here. This is what mindfulness truly is. It's not just ordinary, just knowing. It's putting energy into the knowing through stillness, through letting go of doing, energizing the mind, creating brightness, creating happiness, creating depth of your penetration. And if you're going to have, if you want enlightenment, if that's your goal, to be a stream winner, once returned, non-returned, arahant, if you want to see that depth of Dhamma, do you really think you can do that with ordinary mindfulness? No way. Once you know what true mindfulness is, power mindfulness, superpower mindfulness, you just know how a waste of time it is to contemplate anicca, dukkha, anatta without samadhi. Without power, you're just scratching at the surface. It's like trying to dig a hole with a spoon. In Penang, there are these big earth movers, JCBs, excavators. In Western Australia, because we've got many mines, they've got these huge excavators. Just with one swoop of their bucket, they can take out a piece of earth half the size of this hall. They're huge things. If you were digging out that size of earth with a spoon, it'll take you a couple of years. The big excavator is like superpower mindfulness. Ordinary mindfulness is like digging with a spoon. A blunt spoon at that. This is the difference. If you really want enlightenment, if you want to see the Dhamma, if you want to see anicca, if you want to see dukkha, if you want to see anatta, you really want to dig that out. Empower your mind, first of all. If you're going to play tennis, if you're going to play soccer, if you're going to play any sport to a high level, don't you have to be fit and strong first? Do you think you can play tennis to a high level when you don't go to the gym, push weights, exercise and get all your muscles in tip-top position? How do you expect to get the Olympic gold medals of stream winning, once returning, non-returning, arahat, without getting your mind in tip-top condition? This is what samadhi does. Strengthens the mind. In that causal sequence, which I was talking about throughout this retreat, from happiness, from sukha, comes samadhi, stillness. From stillness comes seeing things as they truly are. From sukha, this is happiness, comes samadhi. From samadhi comes insight. That's what the Buddha said. That's how it works. I think I've explained to you why it works, how it works. So the path of insight is this amazing, joyful path. Joy is necessary to gain insight. Happiness to samadhi to insight is the path of the Buddha. Again and again he said that. So, now is your opportunity to build up your mindfulness through anapanasati. Those who fulfill anapanasati fulfill the four foundations of mindfulness, said the Buddha. But I just read it out at the beginning. Majjhima Nikaya 118, paragraph 15. So, this is what you're doing. If you go home and say, was this a Vipassana retreat? Was it a Samatha retreat? You say, it was both. We did Anapanasati to fulfill the Satipatthanas. But really, if you go back, please call this retreat a third Noble Truth retreat, not a second Noble Truth retreat. I think that is perhaps the best description. Okay, that's a little talk on mindfulness, giving you some more instructions. When you teach, you should be teaching people things they don't know, extending their understanding. If I just taught things which you already knew, there would be no point in me talking about them. Hopefully, you've seen a deeper meaning of mindfulness, extending your understanding of the Buddha's teachings. So, any questions about that? Any questions or comments about what I've just said about mindfulness? Yeah. You say it's all right to fall asleep. Isn't sloth and torpor one of the hindrances? It is one of the hindrances. I'm not challenging that. But I'm saying, how is sloth and torpor overcome? How do you overcome the hindrance? Most people overcome the hindrance by fighting it, by not allowing it to be. And I'm saying that for that hindrance, that's not how it is overcome. I say that's a hindrance. The way it's overcome is by leaving it alone, by being at peace with it, allowing it to be, having compassion towards it. The door of my heart's open to you. It's a hindrance, but when you try and overcome it, is it really overcome? Too often people struggle with sloth and torpor for so many years, and they can't get rid of it. When it does go, it's just restlessness. They subdue restlessness in sloth and torpor. That is the reason why that happens. It is a hindrance, but the point is, how is that hindrance overcome? It is not through struggling. Yes. Now it starts with Dhammavicaya. Dhammavicaya, seven enlightenment factors. That's what Sati starts with, isn't it? Seven enlightenment factors, what is it?
Middle.
Okay, yes. Seven enlightenment factors, I'm just getting my mind clear now. That's right, Sati, it starts with. It starts with mindfulness. For Dhammavicaya is the next, investigation of Dhamma. Then Viriya is number three. Passati, tranquility. It's pity. It's Sati, Dhammavicaya. It's Viriya, pity, Passati, Samadhi, Upeka. Those are the seven. Start with mindfulness, which I've just been talking about. The next one is Dhammavicaya, like investigating the Dhamma. Viriya is energy. It's not energy of the body, it's energy of the mind. Which leads to piti, the joy, which leads to prasadi, tranquility. The mind is still, the body is still. Which leads to samadhi, which leads to upeka, equanimity. Those are the seven enlightenment factors. Viriya is in there, energy. When do you feel energetic? After decent samadhi, you feel very energetic. But it's not the restless energy, it's the energy of the mind. Yeah. It does actually, yes, one factor does lead to the other. In that way, one of the sutras, it shows how one factor leads to the other. Any other question there? Okay. So now you know what mindfulness is. This is a mindfulness retreat, fulfilling the Satipatthanas. So make your mind so still by practicing Anapana. Not Anapana, Anapana. To be able to watch the breath with full mindfulness, from the very beginning to the very end. It gets easier as the retreat goes on. As mindfulness becomes stronger, it's so easy to watch the breath. When the mind is bright, you can watch anything in depth. And the breath becomes so beautiful, just like that clump of bamboo or the piece of concrete. What once you thought was boring becomes the most beautiful thing in the world. That's why that beautiful breath is a sign that mindfulness is growing strong. You see the breath, it's so lovely. Get your mindfulness strong, and it's easy to watch the breath. Okay, so now's the time for the interviews. Those who have the interviews down in the library, those who don't have the interviews, now is the chance. The next 2.5 hours. Huge amount of time and you don't have to do anything. You're free to build up your mindfulness. Put all the energy into knowing. So the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger and stronger. None into doing. Don't try and change. Struggle. Make peace. Make mindfulness. Don't make war.